Dwayne's going to run this panel, Dwayne Roth. I just want to say a little thing about Dwayne. There was a dinner last night. Bob Klein was there. One of the things that Bob Klein said in passing was, Dwayne was right here at the very beginning of this thing. And if there's one refrain I've heard said about Dwayne Roth, it's usually that. He was at the beginning of lots of things and helping people along. And that's certainly true of the Science Network. He was here at the very beginning, helped me enormously, and I'd just like to thank him personally for having been such a great supporter over the years. Dwayne is actually the CEO of Connect, as you probably know, and is vice chairman, was elected vice chairman of the CIRM Oversight Board in 2009. But I'll let you do the rest of it from then. Dwayne Roth, thank you.
So thank you very much. So this morning you heard a lot about some really great science and great research, and you heard the term translational many times. And you can't really go to any meeting today where you talk about healthcare, science, that you don't hear that term translational. So this panel is a bit different. It's about the patients. So how many in the audience either are directly affected or have an immediate family member affected by disease? Virtually all of us. And so the concept here that we're going to try to talk about in this panel is how much should patients be involved in the most important decisions about therapies, new therapies, risk and benefit? And I'm going to rely on my panel. We're not really having a presentation. I'm going to make a little introductory talk about something that I'm going to propose as a new way to think about patient advocacy. So if you think about patient advocacy 1.0, it was mostly about trying to get more research done, understand why these bad things happen, and what, if anything, we can do about those. 2.0 is at the complete other end of the spectrum. It's about being directly involved in the decisions about what medicines get approved and how they get approved. And so we're going to discuss that in terms of ethics, in terms of a patient, and in terms of people who are out trying to help patient advocacy groups get involved. So a very quick introduction to the panel. Michael Kalachman is head of the Center for Ethics at UCSD. He's no stranger to this meeting. I think he's been involved from the early days for embryonic stem cell research and led us through some of the best presentations I've ever heard from Catholic priests, from all aspects of how to think about embryonic stem cell research. So Michael will be the bioethicist, if you will. Next to Michael is Danny Grady. Danny Grady is one of the very first people I ran into in this community. Bill Otterson was head of Connect. Bill had cancer. And Bill had a group of cancer advocates along with him that stood in a line outside this building and went toe-to-toe with patient animal activists who are trying to close this down. And they said, you know, we have another side to this story, and we're going to tell it. We're going to stand here with you. And every Saturday when they'd come, Bill and Danny and all of those patient advocates would show up and represent what they felt was very important to the future of research. So it's so wonderful to have Danny back. Lorraine Steele is now representing the CIRM in terms of our patient advocacy outreach. This is a very important part of what we do at CIRM, and I'm going to talk about that in the context of the concept that I'm going to present, and then we're going to explore that concept really from these three different perspectives. So on the slide, you see there were four things that were suggested that are important that we could consider. One is clinical trials and preclinical research and how that should move forward. What are the criteria to enroll patients into clinical trials? Should we be spending more time thinking about who gets in and why, as opposed to a pretty narrow group that gets treated with these new, potentially new therapies? And the third one is the negotiations with the Food and Drug Administration or other regulatory bodies about what products go forward and why. And the fourth is choices about therapies, once they're approved, that you can actually have prescribed and get. Who's going to get which products for what course of disease? So we decided to focus today, since these are all large topics, on number three. And we chose that because we think it's fundamental to maybe some of the other things we could do in the other areas. So this concept began when I joined the board of the California Institute of Regenerative Medicine. There are 29 members, 10 of which are patient advocates. And I thought, going in, this is going to be a disaster. They're going to each argue for their area of disease. They're going to try to represent their disease and make sure those grants get funded. And this will be uncontrollable. After sitting in those meetings for the last 4 years, I will tell you, I couldn't have been more wrong about that. And that started me thinking about how we could take the concept that had been evolved out of this board of overseers and actually use that to change the dialogue between the companies that are making the new drugs and the regulators that are regulating them. And so that led me to begin to think very seriously about a new way that, as I describe it, would take the bias that normally exists. The company sees all the good they could do for a patient, and they're trying to get that brand new innovative product to their patients. The regulator sees all the risk, and they're biased to say, yes, there's great benefit, but we have to know it's safe, and we have to know that it's not going to cause a problem. And the more innovative it is, meaning there's nothing before it, the more questions we're going to ask. So we have tried over the last two decades to fix that bias. And we tried it by getting more medical people involved at the FDA. We've tried to fix it by writing rules about how soon you have to be told to move to the next phase. All of that over the last two decades has done what? Takes longer, costs more. And that's the outcome of all the money that went into that, all the effort where everybody tried to do it. And I would say that no matter what you do with writing new rules and new ways to look at this, you will not change that behavior. It will always be, as a regulator, I see risk. And as a company, I see benefit. So the question is, who could help us fix this bias? Well, who's the people who are most directly involved? The patients. So suppose you took our experience at CIRM, where they brought the scientist and industry together to make decisions, and you tried that at the FDA. Today, the patients are where? When this new innovative product is discussed between the FDA team and the company team, the patients are in the hallway. They're not allowed in the room. They wait for the news coming out of the hallway because they're hopeful, but they're not in the room. And so if we were to allow them in the room, it's their disease, could they help us look at risk and benefit? So the bottom line of what I really learned from these patient advocates when I had to spend a lot of time with them is only they could see risk and benefit. I thought I could see it, and then I realized my bias. I watched how they digested this information and how they asked the right kinds of questions and then how they made decisions. And it was nothing close to what I would have anticipated. So the concept here is, can you engineer into the room a patient mediator group? A group of people, not one, but a group of people who are directly affected by the disease. One more thing I want to point out from this experience. The people who are directly affected, patient advocates, are different than the people representing the patient advocates. They are completely different. It's not that there aren't good people, they just don't see it the same way. So the four or five people that are directly affected on that board are the ones who are the most able to look at risk and benefit, not the people representing the disease. And so the idea would be that you would take patients or their families who have an immediate family member, and you'd have a statistician, you'd have a regulatory expert, you'd have a clinical expert, and they would be there, the three teams, from day one. And they would help get people together. So, one example. You all know the study Geron for spinal cord injury. It was delayed 1.5 years because it could have been carcinogenic, caused cancer, and there was a concern. But somehow I think if Don Reed, whose son Reuben Reed, was injured in a football game in Orange County, spinal cord injuries in a wheelchair, and Don hasn't missed one meeting. I've been to every meeting, and Don has too. Whether it's a conference call, a subcommittee meeting, he's at every meeting. And I promise you, if Don were in that room, he would have said to the regulator, look, we understand that this could cause cancer, and let's do the studies. The company is doing the studies. But let the next father and son, who have 2 weeks to decide, make that decision themselves, with their doctor, with all the experts, with all the warnings, and let's not wait 1.5 years till you get the results of the study. I promise you that would be the kind of way Don Reed would look at it, as opposed to the regulator, if I were the regulator. And then Don would say, and you know what? If it doesn't work out, we got your back. We did this together. The three of us. We made a decision to go forward. Or he would say, I just think the risk is too great to do that, and I think we should go ahead and complete the study. So the idea is the regulator has somebody behind them when they make these difficult decisions. And to the company, they say, tell us everything. Don't hold anything back because we won't overreact to it. Today, you don't show the FDA everything until you know for sure what the information is. But I would have loved to, over my career, told the FDA, look, I'm a little concerned about this. And we're looking at it. Here's what we're doing. And we'd like to get your input on that before we go ahead. We never had that opportunity because it was too dangerous, because we put the regulator in this very difficult position. We've exposed them to something. They have to make a reaction to it. In this model, the patient would say, Duane, tell me everything. And if you don't tell me and something bad happens, you're on your own. You're on your own. But tell me everything and see if we can move this ahead. So with that as a concept, I'm going to ask the three panelists each to go through and talk a little bit about anything they'd like on these four issues, but to really focus in. And I'm going to start with Michael, because I believe that it's unethical to have the people most affected have to sit in the hallway. I think they need to be directly in the room. And if we can change that, I think we change everything. So we'll start with the ethicist. Thank you.
Thanks. So I knew generally what Duane was going to cover this morning, and until I heard him, I wasn't quite sure how I wanted to cast my response. But I think I should begin by saying just a little bit about ethics in a context that may not be as familiar as it should be to most of you. So how many of you have already been involved in submitting an application to an IRB, so you know what an IRB protocol looks like and what they do for reviewing a project? So it's not quite half, but that means that more than half of you aren't familiar with what the IRB, probably aren't familiar with what the IRB is trying to do. It really gets to the core of what Duane has just discussed for all four of those areas on the previous slide. One of the key issues the IRB has to look at is the question of risks and benefits. And it seems simple on the surface. You might have heard about the cost benefit, you know, the risk-benefit ratio. And it seems simple that there might be some way to calculate this, but there isn't any easy way to calculate. There isn't a number you put on in the numerator, a number you put in the denominator. It's an attempt to try and figure out what we might get out of this versus what might go wrong in the process. And in that process, it seems, even if you accept that that was hard, but if you go to the next step, it's still hard to figure out what you're going to do with that. Who gets to decide whether that risk-benefit ratio, even though you can't quite calculate it, who gets to decide whether it's acceptable? Now, right now, the system is sort of set up so that you have the researchers proposing what they want to do, presuming that the risks are less than the benefits of doing this research. You have the IRB reviewing the project, saying they think that it's acceptable. But ultimately, the right person, the right place to look for the answer to that question isn't the IRB and the researcher. It's got to be the person who's going to put their life on the line or their potential for pain and suffering on the line. So that fundamental issue, I think, permeates all of those questions of, well, how do we choose which research we should do? Which kinds of diseases will be worked on? How do we choose how do we decide whether somebody's going to be part of this clinical trial or not? And specifically, point number three, should those people who will be affected by this the most be part of the conversation about when and how something gets approved? So those kinds of questions all come back to who should make the decision. Now, as an ethicist, in the sense that I view ethicists, I'm not going today to do any blessing of any particular direction or decision, but instead I'm going to try and put on the table why we are where it's not simple and why we are where we are, and we need to figure out how to move to someplace that's better than we are, because I would argue that, as Duane said, that it's probably not ethical the way it is now. We probably need to do something better. And the reason we are where we are is because of the fear, the worry, that Duane highlighted when he talked about what he thought he would see when he went to become a member of the CIRM ICOC, the Independent Citizens Oversight Committee. He would fear that he would see people that who probably at best were parochial in their interests and at worst didn't understand the science or how it works or where things were going. That's not what he found, but that's behind the reason that we worry about leaving it to the public to decide which research we should fund. It's why we worry about deciding, leaving it up to individuals, whether they should be part of a clinical trial. It's why we worry about somebody deciding as an individual whether, when they sign that informed consent document, whether they really understand it. So there's a term in the ethics field that is the appropriate term for what we're talking about. It's paternalism. And it's a good to have a father or a mother, somebody who looks over what we do and says, this is okay and that's not okay. But sometimes that may be more invasive than it should be. And I think that on the table, and I'm going to leave my comments now, just say, on the table is that perhaps we've erred too much on the side of paternalism. And if we have, then are there mechanisms that can help us protect against the wrong decisions on the part of an individual to enter themselves in a study, or on a part of a group of individuals to say, we want this drug approved now, even though we don't know if it's really safe? Is there a way to avoid those errors and still protect against paternalism? So I'll leave it at that.
So Danny, you've been directly in the middle of what I just described. Would you share with the audience your perspective of what you went through and some of the, you're very advanced in understanding this relationship and how it affected you?
Well, I took great pains to wear something cute today. So you would all perceive me as like you. I am someone who, I have a medical record about the size of 4 New York phone books. And I was diagnosed with the advanced recurrent breast cancer at the age of 29. You can do the math, but I've had many years now, 23 years of living through making tough decisions in a very difficult setting, and really having experience in the system that I think I can speak fairly well to this idea. I think of words that are perhaps misused in this setting about patients. I think of desperate, last chance, emotional, distraught. Those are certainly all words that you can use diagnosed with a serious illness and looking at the possibility of having your lifespan cut very short. But very important about that is those, you could all describe that for me when I was going through my experience, but when the shockwaves settle and you realize that no one in the room can care about this as much as you do, it's your life is on the line, and you also have to make the best decision for yourself. And I think that as someone who is also, I've spent the last 20 some years building programs for patients. We have a navigator program for patients. I've talked to literally thousands of people at that very decision point. And I really do believe that patients are able to articulate very well, to make the very best decisions for themselves. And I say the word patient, but every single person in this room, every one of you, is one bad pathology report or doctor's call away from being a patient. And that's very important because we have to think of ourselves in that in those terms. We're not talking about the other here. We're talking about an integral part of the process to discovery for advancement of research. And I know that it's a lot of trouble. I was a person, when I first started my career when I went to UCSD, I was a person that I wanted to be there to, I was the ombudsman. I said, I think I can help solve your problem of people calling up who are desperate for a therapy, who've gotten the news on the 6 o'clock news and the nightly news, and now you have 300 phone calls to field in a day. So instead of making that an intrusion in the process, I really think there's absolutely no reason why we can't integrate that in the process. And we can get good information to people so that they can help not only make good decisions about the therapies that come up and participate in the process, but also what I think is, as someone who's been on the Institute Review Board for the VA and UCSD for 7 years, I've sat through hours and hours and hours of meetings with physicians, and we have come to a great way of being able to help fix the designs of these clinical trials. But I'm always sitting there thinking, why didn't somebody call me up ahead of time? I could have saved them time from this you know, a denial or a pending by getting patients in the process. And to say, there are very practical things that I'm really stunned when I sit across the room and these people, there are about 10 physicians, and I've known them for all these 7 years. We know each other like neighbors. I don't know if they're married, have kids, or anything, but we all know each other very well, and we know what our point of view is. And the interesting thing is I look and I'll think, how can they not put themselves, how can they not see that this would be, if you're looking at it as this is my life and I'm laying on that table, how can you not see as a just a rational human being that would be a deal breaker? So why don't you have patients, why don't we bring patients in some form, and we'll have to figure out a way, is there a training program or is there a way to identify people so that they're inside the process so we can speed things up? And there are so many areas that we can do that.
Thank you, Danny. Yeah. So, Danny, I want to come back to the panel on the concept of getting patients involved much earlier, and that's really what I'm prospectively, not after the fact, but prospectively involved in all aspects, including what you just talked about with IRBs and certainly in the concept here from day one of this innovative new product, to be involved and see all the information at the same time in the same room, as opposed to waiting until it's all done and then you ask the question, how could you not approve it, you know, this to go forward? Lorraine, you spent many, many years in this field of advocacy. I would suspect that much of that was on getting research funded to find out why. So I'm interested in your perspective.
Sure. First of all, I'm delighted that CIRM has created this new patient advocacy role. My husband and I are playing the role, and we just started in the last couple of months. This is not a new arena. I was actually very involved with Prop 71. Managing disease groups out there, at least 70 of them, and working on the Get Out the Vote effort. So to be here today and see what we've accomplished from Prop 71 is very exciting. I've also been involved for 25 years in the Juvenile Diabetes Research Foundation. My husband's had type 1 diabetes for 50 years. And JDRF is quite an organization because they have been proactively influencing things federally, both the research side, raising more money through and or encouraging the NIH to direct more money to medical research, but they've also been very innovative in influencing the agenda for type 1 diabetes and truly for other autoimmune diseases. They have actually been in there as patient advocates. I actually right now serve for the Juvenile Diabetes Research Foundation as their national chair for grassroots advocacy. I actually lead 80 30,000 advocates who are very vocal on this issue. And because the numbers speak well to both Congress, but also to other organizations like the FDA, and you know, we have been able to create that agenda, that research agenda, and help influence it as patient advocates. What Duane is now talking about in terms of really having a place at the table in the FDA to really weigh in on all those questions, I think is terrific and much needed, because unfortunately we're not innovating. I mean, we're trying to innovate, and it's challenging. And there are the patient community is frustrated. I was with a group of HIV/AIDS patients up in Los Angeles a couple of weeks ago for CIRM, and I think many of you have probably heard of the Berlin patient, and we're so very excited about therapies for stem cell. One of the first diseases that may be impacted is HIV/AIDS. Why do we have to call it the Berlin patient? Why can't it be why couldn't this research have been done here? And so I think when you energize this community and look at out-of-the-box ways of thinking, like JDRF has done, but what Duane is proposing and what CIRM is actually leading with here, I think the sky's the limit, and we can accomplish just so much. And these patient advocates want a role. They are anxious and willing to play this role. I should mention, I've also done a fair amount of work recruiting for clinical trials. I am talking to patients, parents of kids, 7, 8, 9 years old, who have type 1 diabetes, newly diagnosed, and I'm trying to get them interested in an intervention study where the consent form is this big, right? And somewhere in there, it says there's a chance of death, and yet, diabetes is a chronic disease. You can live with it, right? Type 1. I mean, shortens life by a third still, but that's very difficult process. But the parents can do that risk-benefit analysis, and you'd be surprised how many of these parents are willing to take that chance. I've also done some work in doing recruitment for clinical trials in cancer, lymphoma in particular. Very different world in terms of the cancer patient and the decision-making they go through than the type 1 parent. So it's fascinating, but clearly what we're all talking about is empowerment on the part of this patient and really improving the system overall. So all the great work that all of you do in your labs each and every day can really make an impact and cure diseases and save lives. So again, I applaud Duane for pulling this discussion together, because I don't think we talk about this as often as we should.
So thank you. The concept here is to really think about the other end of the spectrum, which I mentioned. So the research side is very important and needs to continue. But research isn't products. And the translational piece that goes on there and the decision making that's being done on behalf of the biotechnology and pharmaceutical companies around the world is what really concerns me. I grew up in that environment. So talk about innovation, and I'm going to ask the panel to react to these things. But there's three things that I'm going to put out that bother me. One is risk and benefit on diseases like type 1 diabetes. At my day job at Connect, the investors are so disinterested now in anything diabetes, because the regulatory hurdle is perceived to be minimal, 10 years of trials. And they're just walking away. I won't even touch it. So if I were in the Juvenile Diabetes Foundation, I talked to them the other day, they're very concerned about that. They haven't a clue what to do about it, because that's the way it's going to be perceived. So investors will walk away. The second is related. It's childhood diseases. The risks for doing something good for children is so outweighed by doing something bad. It's just the risk and benefits out of proportion there. So companies walk away from that. The third is repurposing or off-label use for very small patient populations, rare diseases. And I can't tell you how many times people have stood in front of the board at CIRM and talked about this drug or that drug that could help their disease, but they can't get it because the company is so fearful that they'll be accused of selling something off-label or marketing off-label, and the insurance company won't pay for it because it's not approved. So it sits there. How do we resolve this? So to me, those are big ethical issues, and I'm going to ask each of the panelists to add or comment on those or add some of their own. And then I want to come back to how we might take this concept and make sure the safeguards that you mentioned, Michael, can be looked at to make sure we don't have the emotional thing, as Danny so elegantly said, don't get too concerned, but there is concern about that, so.
Yeah, so those are three neat in the sense of challenging ideas. The risk benefit of, the first two, the risk benefit challenges that somebody has in engaging in studies, whether on a disease because they're gonna have to work so long on it, it's gonna cost so much to do that, and they may not be able to make that much at the other end of it. And the risk of working on childhood diseases and similarly risk of working on vaccines. These are areas where the cost of trying to develop it just probably can't be paid off at the other end. I'm going to throw out the sense that I'm not sure that that's going to readily be solved by bringing patients to the table. Maybe I haven't thought this through well enough, but I think that those probably require some sort of different systemic solution. Bringing patients to the table might push harder to say we need to find a solution to those issues, but it may not be the answer to those.
Let me push back on that, and I think this is something that we need to consider. When I ask patient advocacy groups the following questions, I ask two. How would you design a clinical trial for this disease? Most of them can't answer that. And I said, if I were in a disease association, I would prospectively design such a trial with the best people you can pull together. And the second question I asked them, what would be the value of treating or curing your disease? And they give some numbers that they read someplace, but they don't understand what those numbers mean. So just pushing back on this, companies will follow if you lead them. Right now, and I've described this, you're asking the companies to drive the bus to Washington, D.C. And everybody's a backseat driver. The FDA is a backseat driver. Consumers are backseat drivers. Patient advocates are backseat drivers. And we don't get to Washington. But what if you drove the bus and we rode with you as part of that team? So it's getting the concept is it's your disease. You define the path. And then in those boardrooms where these decisions are made, they're saying, the Juvenile Diabetes Association said that. That's their number and their recommendation. That's different than me as a product manager saying, here's how I think we're going to do it. And they go, Duane, come on. Childhood disease, 10 years, you're never going to see this thing. But if I could say, no, they're out in front of us here, and we now have a pathway to get there. So back to you.
It's a good point. I'm not sure that it would work for all diseases, but there are certainly some for which there is right now not enough of a financial incentive to study. And having the marketing data that says that people are willing to pay this much, much more than might have been anticipated, would be an additional driving force. I think systemically, I can't imagine though that, I mean, for some of the issues, the risks of doing studies in newborns and children, the risks of doing vaccine studies are so big, and often it's hard to imagine, at least off the top of my head, that in all those cases, we're gonna be able to charge enough to balance that. So systemically, we probably have to do something to fix that. But implicit in what you just covered as a solution is a reminder that I wanted to respond in part to what Danny was proposing. I mean, if we're looking for solutions, one of the solutions, I think, is to bring people who can articulate these issues closer to the design of the studies. To those of you who are designing clinical trials, why shouldn't we expect that you don't just have the scientists design the clinical trial, but they have somebody who can say, this is what it means to be a patient, and to bring the words that we just heard from Danny that, I mean, that might convince somebody who didn't have the disease to understand it better, and that might be part of the answer, separate from the FDA question, but part of the answer.
Danny?
Well, I think the problem solving in this is very interesting because I don't know, some of you are a little younger, but there was probably, I think it was during the Clinton years, but there was a very big issue. I'm a woman who's had a mastectomy, and but there was a very big issue about what they call drive-through mastectomies. And that became a legislative edict that you had to have women were they had to have a day or two of hospitalization as part of. So this was something that the public could understand. They thought it was horrendous. You'd have this terrible operation, then all of a sudden they shuffle you home. I've had a mastectomy, and I didn't want to stay in the hospital very long, and I don't want to spend millions of dollars to tell a doctor you know, you should have somebody be exposed to germs in the hospital just because maybe they'll feel more comforted. There's other ways the systems can do that. But what I think what we're talking about here, so that's misdirected, you know, funds in the United, in our financial system and the insurance industry. But more importantly, there are so many things. I thought this often for the years that I spent talking to people on the phone and seeing them in person. And I always thought there are so many instances where you would never hear of it. You're not going to hear about the challenge of someone who's going through an odd rectal surgery and they didn't have this type of procedure, so then now they're not eligible for a clinical trial. There are these little, these connectivity problems that will never see the light of day. But something like a good-looking gal with breast cancer, we're all over the country. You'll pay extra money for us to stay longer, you'll go get a pink ribbon, and I'm proud of that. But what I'm saying is the solving of the problem isn't going to be that quick fix. It's getting dirty and taking the time to groom people, to figure out how to incorporate people in the system so that we come out with, at the other end, clinical trials and treatments that people actually want to be on. So in the United States now, the clinical trial accrual is around 5% for adults in cancer. I mean, it's absolutely abysmal. And if you look at the flip side of that in childhood cancers, it's just the majority of kids and the gains we've had in data and refining treatments in childhood cancers are so stunning. It's absolutely reversed the outcome of treatment in that setting. So why don't adults get involved in the clinical trials? Because there's no way to get in part of the process. There, when you talk to a doctor, you're trying to figure out who's for you, who's really in my best interest here. There's no kind of a way for a group to mediate, to explain to them and say, what I would do, and the hundreds of clinical trials that I've seen come through the IRB, I would say, here's what it is. Here's the real deal for you. Let the doctor explain it to you. Now have someone say, this is what it means. What are your values in your life? What do you care about? What is it, you know, what are your goals for the rest of your life? And those things are not addressed now currently in the system. It's a very rough system, I know in cancer very well, to get through to the end where you actually will sign on the dotted line after the 23-page consent and think somehow you understood all the big words in that. That it means, and you got caught on the things that say death or you know, blindness, or all those great things that you get to read in for your the possibilities of the things that can go wrong. But you really, there's no way for people to really internalize that in this process that we have now.
Brian.
I agree on the clinical trials. I think there's also a challenge with people don't know about these clinical trials. They're developing more registries. It sounds like you're involved with one. I've seen others sprouting up. You just can't send them to the NIH's clinical trials website and try to navigate it, because if you've tried, it's very difficult. And so I think knowledge is power in some of this. I do want to go to diabetes again, sorry for all of the examples of the Juvenile Diabetes Research Foundation, but I have these examples for a reason, I think, because they have really tried to do some of what Dwayne and the panelists are talking about, I know most of you are involved in cellular therapies. I'm going to move off into just medical device areas for a second, because the JDRF is very interested in an artificial pancreas. We have pump technology. We have continuous glucose sensor technology. We're trying to merge them together and have a continuous loop system. And early on, we hired, JDRF hired regulatory experts who could work with the FDA early on these clinical trials. What do we need? What do you want? Now, granted, the FDA is known to change their mind sometimes, but being their partner early on in the process, I think, has been very positive. The Juvenile Diabetes Research Foundation was one of the first organizations who actually took all their clinical trial data, and they actually were published in the New England Journal of Medicine. And that was particularly on the continuous glucose sensors. But what was interesting, in 2007, the FDA actually gave the JDRF an award. And it's interesting, they called it the Leveraging and Partnership Award. And it was the very first time, we think, that the FDA has really given a voluntary health agency an award. Now, that's all the positive, that we can work together. And patients, by the way, were very involved in that effort. I mean, JDRF is really composed by patient leaders who have skill sets in comparable areas, but they're still patient advocates. JDRF was involved in that whole process. What's unfortunately, you know, you think you make some progress and you have some steps forward, and then you feel like you take the step back. And I don't know if anybody saw last Friday in the New England Journal of Medicine, the new FDA commissioner had a story about the FDA, and it was a little bit of the history of the FDA and a justification of the FDA, but was so frightening and sad, you know, very frustrating. Was at the very end of this article, she was talking about the need for all the stakeholders to be there together working on this. She talked about industry. She talked about academic medicine. She talked about government. She talked about it all. The one stakeholder she did not talk about, patients. Isn't that the ultimate stakeholder? And this was in Friday's New England Journal of Medicine article from the FDA commissioner. So as much as I share the positive that some of these things can be done, and the JDRF has shown those examples, we've got a ways to go.
Great. And take some questions from the audience. Hold on for the microphone.
So Bernie Siegel from the Genetics Policy Institute.
First, this has been an incredible panel. Thank you, Duane. And the organizers for this. There's a lot of synergies in this room. I'm a patient advocate. I could have been in my grave at 48 with colon cancer, and I'm an active adult at 61 now. What does it all mean? I'm reading a book, Emperor of All Maladies. It's about the history of cancer, and I've just read about Mary Lasker. And at the time, the word breast and cancer couldn't be put in the New York Times. It was too offensive and scary. And she teamed up with Dr. Dana and created the Real American Cancer Society and ignited a field, and Dr. Gurdon is in the room and received the Lasker Award. It was that energy of patient advocates that changed everything. As a patient advocate, and we produced the World Stem Cell Summit, the only event where the medical philanthropies and the patients in wheelchairs can meet the bench scientist and get those synergies going. It's an important thing to bring the scientists and the patients together. Don Reed, who I have known for 8 years, it was a small group of people who met on the internet who were passionate about stem cells. I talked to Don every week, and Roman Reed, his son. And bringing it home to stem cells, which I think is significant, when the political foes of this nascent field overreached and politicized this issue, it made an obscure area of developmental biology famous and important. So that 72% of the population, if you ask, do you support stem cell research, they're going to say yes, not because they see it as a public health issue, because they see it as a personal health issue impacting their lives, the lives of their friends and their loved ones. It is this, if we seize upon this and realize this is how the public understands NIH funding, this is how the public is now becoming aware that we can cure a mouse of diabetes, it's going to take 35 years to be a person. This is hugely significant. Now this whole field is igniting again over the issue of embryonic stem cells because of a court case, because of Dickey Wicker and all those issues that you're familiar with. The public is getting engaged again. My group has initiated the Stem Cell Action, stemcellaction.org, a stem cell action campaign that we hope will grow to 500 organizations. And it's not the JDRFs that are terrific, but it's the Baby Alex Foundation and the Adam Susser Foundation and all of these tiny groups that are out there that are the face. For us to make this happen, you have to have a narrative. You have to have a narrative, and the narrative is the patient. And I agree 100% with the observations that Duane has made, that Danny, that all of you have made. I'm so impressed with this panel. And stem cells is the consumer movement that brought in Prop 71 and made stem cells a fundamental right in three state constitutions by ballot measure. It's the movement, it's the engine that will drive what we're talking about in patient advocacy 2.0, in my belief. Thank you for this panel.
Thank you. Another quick question. Okay.
Yeah, one question I have about the notion of organizing patient advocacy is that it appears that not all patient advocacy is the same, and it looks as though it varies by disease. And it may be varying according to how debilitating for the individual it is over the long haul and also by the age. So I suspect that juvenile diabetes is very strong because the parents are in good health and enormously motivated. That cancer has a great deal of advocacy because people recover to a degree sufficient to allow them to be energetic about it. Clearly, there are a lot of diseases where that never happens. And in addition, these are a general range of issues you're talking about. So perhaps what might be necessary is some kind of a unified consortium of patient advocacy groups that actually does deal with that arises from the patients, as opposed to what are some of the named representative groups, which sometimes don't necessarily represent the patient's interests, as you, Duane, alluded to.
So thank you for that. As I've gone around and talked about this idea, and there actually will be a publication next month from the Hastings Center in the Hastings Report that describes this concept that I laid out for you. And in there we talk about safeguards and some of the things that are important. But it's been suggested that in addition to having patient representatives, I would call them certified to be in that room, they have the capacity and the experience to be in that room as a team, that there needs to be an umbrella one that deals with issues where, for example, there isn't an active advocacy group, but also deals with some of these larger issues that I talked about, off-label use, rare diseases, where you can't get... The most frustrating thing to me is a former, lifetime pharmaceutical biotech person is this concept that you can't get there from here. Mm. And that happens over... And it means there's no regulatory pathway. Mm. There's no reimbursement. There's no... Those are the things that unfortunately we have to, I think, address, or we're never going to address many of these diseases for which you heard. Think about Rusty Gage's talk today. If Rusty's right, how in the world would you do that study in autism at that age? Those are the things we need to think through. I promise you regulators will have a tough time and companies wouldn't touch that. So that's the concept. We need to wrap up, so maybe just one quick final comment from each of you. Yeah.
Quick question. Why hasn't the concept of compassionate use that we've had in orphan medications affected this debate? And what?
So I'll take a quick answer because I want to get these guys in. Compassionate use is really a difficult one because companies whose products you want to grant for this compassionate use are in such a tough time because if that patient dies, because they usually call when it's life and death, if that patient dies, it counts. If they live, it doesn't count. And so this dilemma about, well, if I do it here, and I've been there. I had a blood substitute, so Jehovah's Witnesses would die, bleed out, and I would get these calls begging for the product to save their life. And the problem was, most of them would go on to die anyway. And if we let that happen, it would contaminate our ability to ever get the product to anybody else. So that concept happens over and over again. So I don't think that's the answer, but it is an ethical issue.
But there needs to be a mechanism.
There needs to be.
There
needs to be one.
There needs to be a mechanism.
But the penalties, the problem is the penalty. And again, it's back to if you're in the room, we'll do it.
Right.
Because you can say, you can't do that. You can't count it one way and not the other. And so that's where we need help. The regulator and the company will never figure that out. We're just too biased. But
well,
she's in the room.
I have a personal, I just killed my pen. I'm actually having high-dose chemotherapy for a year and a half, or various times, but for a year and a half. You have high-risk behaviors. I rode my bike across the country. I swam in this channel last year with girlfriends, and I married a scientist. So clearly there's a lot of high-risk behaviors happen that have not been tracked. But my husband has a PhD, but I've always told him I have a PhD. And mine, I didn't go to school for. I'm a patient who hasn't died. And I really do feel a lot of times in my life that I'm sitting right here at this moment, at this time, to speak to you, to let you understand, somehow to have one glimpse. I was in a hospital. I was treated at MD Anderson. I was getting on a plane to go back to MD Anderson for treatment and became septic, couldn't get on the flight. It's life-threatening. I was ended up in a hospital in San Diego. 14 blood transfusions. The doctor had the priest come in to read me my last rites. And my family came in to say goodbye. And I got a call. I couldn't talk. I was seriously extremely ill. And you know the mortality rate on septic fever is very high. And I could only listen on the phone, and it was my physician at MD Anderson, and he said, Danny, my God, I'm so sorry this has happened to you. It's too bad we couldn't get you to Japan for GMCSF. We could have staved this off. This wouldn't have happened to you. I couldn't even say, no, that's all right. You've been a good doctor. Thanks. I laid there and watched the clock tick off what seemed to be an eternity, trying to live for the next 5 minutes to hold on to my life. That scenario, I'm alive to tell you about that. That can happen in any of your lives, any of your loved ones, for any delay that we have, that we haven't tried hard enough to push through to get to the answers for stem cell. For God's sake, give the $3 billion. Let's get to this answer. Let's see if we can make some therapies out of it. And then let's move on. But let's all work together to get there.
On that, I'm going to end this panel. Thank you very much to all the panelists.